Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. The U.S. missile strike against Syria in retaliation to a chemical weapons attack that killed 100 civilians is threatening relations between the U.S. and Russia, a staunch ally of the Syrian government that has been blamed for the toxic gas attack. Russian President Vladimir Putin said early Friday the attack will inflict major damage on U.S.-Russia ties and was in violation of international law. That's according to a statement issued by the Kremlin. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, said at an emergency U.N. meeting, defended the U.S.'s actions while criticizing Russia, saying that Russia is supposed to have removed all of the chemical weapons from Syria, but obviously that has not happened.
I'm shocked.
The U.S. military fired 59 missiles into Syria, the first direct U.S. assault on Syrian government forces. The U.S. strike against Syria, a key Russian ally, has heightened the attention on U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's visit to Russia next week. It is unclear if the U.S. action will impact the Tillerson meeting with his Russian counterpart. Tillerson travels to Moscow after attending the G7 ministers' meeting in Italy next week. Swedish police said Saturday that they have arrested a man that very likely is the driver of the truck who plowed into pedestrians outside a busy department store in Stockholm Friday, killing 4 and injuring 15 others. The Swedish prime minister is calling the incident a terrorist attack. A day after the attack, residents still seem to be shaken by what happened. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for Friday's attack. Sweden's government offices will fly flags at half-staff Saturday as Sweden observes a national day of mourning. This is VOA News. The social media company Twitter is no longer suing the federal government. Twitter says it made the decision after the U.S. government dropped its efforts to force Twitter to identify users behind an account critical of President Donald Trump. Twitter has filed the lawsuit just a day earlier, claiming the government had overstepped its authority in issuing a summons to reveal the account owners. The U.S. Attorney General is not pleased that the Baltimore Department of the Atlantic Coast City of Baltimore is deciding to adhere to an agreement negotiated with the Obama administration. While Jeff Sessions said the consent decree will make Baltimore a less safe city, the Baltimore mayor, Catherine Pugh, disagreed, saying that she believes that it makes Baltimore safer. The U.S. District Judge signed the deal Friday, calling the plan comprehensive and detailed and precise. The Trump administration has asked him to delay signing the decree to give them more time to review the plan designed to root out racist practices in Baltimore's police department, Baltimore 65 kilometers north of Washington, D.C. The consent decree was negotiated during the last days of the Obama administration after a federal investigation found a rampant abuse by Baltimore police, including unlawful stops and use of excessive force against African Americans. The U.S. Senate has confirmed Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch, bringing a contentious 14-month partisan battle to a close after the death of Justice Antonin Scalia. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell:
he's going to make an incredible addition to the court. He's going to make the American people proud.
The final confirmation came after Senate Republicans rewrote the rules, voting to eliminate the 60-vote filibuster threshold on Supreme Court nominees. Leading Senate Democrat Charles Schumer of New York:
I believe it will make this body a more partisan place. It will make the cooling saucer of the Senate considerably hotter. And I believe it will make the Supreme Court a more partisan place.
Authorities in western Myanmar say a ferry carrying scores of wedding guests capsized in a river, killing 20 people. Emergency workers said the ferry collided with another boat. Officials said at least 9 people were missing and 30 people have been rescued. A day after the Venezuelan government banned Venezuela's opposition leader Enrique Capriles from the public office for 15 years, he's now waging a national campaign for reform.
Aquí sobran las razones para movilizarse. Que esta inhabilitación que me han impuesto sea más razón.
He says he's running and campaigning not as a candidate, but to change all of Venezuela. The sanction effectively bans him from running against the socialist president in a general election next year. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
But the recent attempt to appoint one of her former colleagues and individual that worked for her, Chris Massakoi, to be the ombudsman of this three-person panel that oversees the code of conduct was very troubling to many people.
Liberian opposition party fails to receive an endorsement from the U.S. State Department following a visit to Washington.
I must admit that I was one of the people who were traumatized. I mean, because we didn't know what was going to happen next. I mean, and the policemen who were there in court were not armed because they were not there for a security duty, but to prosecute cases. And so
The Ghanaian Bar Association condemns an attack of a court by a group which calls itself Delta Force.
Most of our countries in Africa, I think, we need to be developed. We need to have an education people. Because if the people in our countries in Africa are not educated, I think it will be very, very difficult for us to be free.
And a lawmaker from the Congo Republic establishes a foundation to help educate the less fortunate. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Senator Jewel Howard Taylor, vice presidential candidate from the Liberian Opposition Congress for Democratic Change, or CDC, has come under criticisms. This after leading a delegation of party officials to Washington, D.C. to visit the State Department. The former wife of the jailed former Liberian leader, Charles Taylor, did not receive an endorsement ahead of next year's election. But critics condemned the visit, saying it was an attempt to deceive prospective voters. Dr. Alan White, former chief of investigations for the United Nations Special Court for Sierra Leone, shared his thoughts about the visit.
Well, it was interesting that she would be allowed to come to the United States in light of the recent revelations that her and the standard bearer were publicly welcoming the return of Charles Taylor, who, as you know, is a convicted war criminal, and certainly, I believe, most of Liberians would not want him to return. And quite frankly, he will not return. He is incarcerated. He will be there throughout the remainder of his sentence. So there's a lot of propaganda and misinformation that is being purported throughout the Liberian community that he's going to return. Charles Taylor is not going to return to Liberia. People need to know that, and they should not be intimidated in voting for people that support the return of Charles Taylor, again, a convicted war criminal responsible for 1.2 million victims in West Africa.
Recently, there are concerns President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf plans to tilt the election outcome in favor of her favorite. What have you heard about this?
Well, there's certainly allegations that have come up, and yes, I've heard those. But the recent attempt to appoint one of her former colleagues and individual that worked for her, Chris Massakoi, to be the ombudsman of this three-person panel that oversees the code of conduct was very troubling to many people. And it's something that I know the U.S. government and the people of Liberia want free and fair elections. And they must follow the rule of law. For example, this 10-year residency, the Supreme Court has already ruled on that. There is no area of where it could be questioned. It's quite clear in the Supreme Court ruled that you must have lived in Liberia for 10 consecutive years.
So why do they bring it up? What is the purpose of doing so?
Well, I think that this is an issue because they've been able to flaunt the other situation. For example, you have members in the government right now that are members of political party. In the Code of Conduct law that was enacted in 2014 prohibits any government official from being directly involved with a political party. Yet you have ministers, sitting ministers, who are actively involved and actually hold positions in political parties. That's against the law. And people are concerned that this law will be ignored, which it shouldn't be. And there's already people that are running for office. For example, one of the candidates announced that he was going to have as his vice standard bearer an individual that was a recent diplomat here in the United States, which violates the 2-year rule that any person that has a job with the Liberian government must resign within 2 years of seeking political office.
Right.
Any government official. Yet this is going on. There has been no investigation into this. I think the Liberian people and certainly the U.S. government, again, wants free and fair elections. They want it followed by the rule of law in Liberia. And it seems that a lot of these people that are running have violated that.
Dr. Alan White is the former chief of investigations for the United Nations Special Court for Sierra Leone. He spoke with me from here in Washington. The Ghana Bar Association has called on the Inspector General of Police to investigate a group blamed for attacking a court in the Ashanti regional capital Kumasi on Thursday. The Lawyers Association sharply condemned the attack and demanded the suspect be prosecuted to serve as a deterrent. The group, calling itself Delta Force, stormed the court, destroyed property and freed 13 of its members who were on trial. They are accused of assaulting a newly appointed security coordinator for the Ashanti region. To learn more, I reached attorney Elvis Asante, who was present in the courtroom during the attack.
I was present in court when case involving the Republic and a group which calls itself as Delta Force came up for hearing for the first time in court. And as practice, the procedure in court was for the prosecutor who was representing the state to give his facts as well as the charge sheet. So those ones were presented to the accused parties. Actually, 13 of them were standing accused. And they all pleaded not guilty to the charges. And what that meant was that the judge had a discretion to either grant them bail or to remand them pending the next date for hearing. Actually, upon hearing counsel for the accused person on his prayer for bail, the judge, in her discretion, thought that the accused person would not come to stand trial and that he refused to grant them bail. And immediately after that, we had members of the Delta, perceived members, well-drilled people who were outside the court premises. And I don't know if they came on board to support the members who were standing trial. They besieged the court amidst noise and all other things that they were not really happy with, just to show their protest that they were not happy with what the ruling was.
Was the place secured by security?
Well, it was usual happenings. The police who were there on duty. Either some of them had brought the accused person to court, and those who were there to prosecute cases which had been assigned to them by their superiors. As a matter of fact, I never saw or I did not see persons who were specifically assigned the task of protecting the people who were there or the judges. I didn't see anything like that. These are people who were engaged in their normal routine jobs.
I understand some of the lawyers, your colleagues, were badly shaken because of the behavior exhibited in court on Thursday.
I must admit that I was one of the people who were traumatized. Because we didn't know what was going to happen next. And the policemen who were there in court were not armed because they were not there for a security duty, but to prosecute cases. And so I was one of those who were, because we could not predict what could happen next. Really traumatized. I was.
What happened to some of the cases they were hearing following this unfortunate incident?
Well, the what happened after they engaged in that was that they actually, amidst shouting and all that, they actually asked their colleagues who were standing accused to just walk away. So the judge was guarded by some of the policemen in the courtroom. they actually put guarded her to her chambers and after the tempest had calmed down. But I was told that the judge came back to testify, but that's when I cannot speak to it.
Some lawyers I spoke with in Ghana were telling me this incident will have some grave impact on the practice of law in Ghana. What are your thoughts?
Very well. I have learned lessons which I can never have a very good classroom to learn, and I must say that, well, next time probably it will be maybe next time such things happen, it might be only counsels who will be representing them with the judge in there, because I wouldn't risk it to witness such a hearing anyway. I don't think I would. I don't think. Unless, of course, I find myself representing them, I don't think I would. Because we have, trust me, we have only been saved by God's grace that some of us are alive. Because if the police had retaliated and this had resulted in brutality, we wouldn't know what would happen in the courtroom, I must confess. We wouldn't know. The story might have been different.
Elvis Asante is a Ghanaian attorney. He spoke with me from Kumasi. Denise Christelle Sassou Nguesso is a lawmaker from the Congo Republic and the son of President Denis Sassou Nguesso. Christelle's election to parliament sparked rumors he is being groomed to be the heir apparent. He was accused of corruption after critics said he spent public funds lavishly on luxurious items, a charge he denies. Christelle was recently in Washington, D.C. to promote his newly established foundation, Perspective Devenir. In a wide-ranging interview, Christelle told me his foundation is a commitment to the education of the financially disadvantaged youth. So, Mr. Nguesso, welcome to the Voice of America.
Thank you for hosting me.
So let me ask you this first. What is your philanthropy work all about?
I think it's my personal vision first. It's my vision for my country, Congo Brazzaville, and I think it's also my vision for all Africa.
What was the motivation behind it? Why did you set it up in the first place?
Because if you see most of our countries in Africa, I think we need to be developed. We need to have an education people. Because if the people in our countries in Africa are not educated, I think it will be very, very difficult for us to be free first, because I think most of our countries, in fact, we are not free really. And I think it will be very difficult for us to face off the challenge of the century.
So representing your people as a member of parliament, did you see some of these things happening which you think motivated you to come up with such a vision?
Yes, because most of the people in my circumscription are very very aware about what I'm doing with my foundation, and people are very happy about that.
But what would you say to some of your critics who say that, well, you came from a rich family, you are a son of the president, what do you know about suffering?
But do you think when you are a son of a president, you are a rich person? Why people are think that? Do you think presidents are very rich? No. I think even if we are a son of a president, you need to be aware about people around you are living every day.
Representing your people in parliament, what were some of the things you did to improve their lives?
To be concrete, I try, for example, to give some medicines to people, because all the people in my region cannot afford to have some medicine. I try to help people to have some medicine. I try also to help people to have some books for kids to going to school. And I try also people to have some good water in some region of the country, because that's be very difficult sometimes. And I try to help. I do my best.
People say that your foundation is basically a part of a well-orchestrated plan to elevate you politically. It's mainly to make you look just good.
So people will say, well, Sassine Nguesso is doing well. Let's vote him next president.
I think it's a view. People who saying that, I don't know why they saying that, but they think that. But I think, according to me, it's not the main goal of my action. It's not to be the next president. That's why I need to build a foundation, because I cannot keep my objective to another things if I want. But I'm doing that because I have this vision for my country, and I have also this vision for my continent.
So what is your current mission here in Washington, D.C.? What did you come to do?
I come in Washington, D.C. because I would like to improve the partnership between my foundation and other organizations in Washington, D.C. And I would like also to explain to people what exactly I'm doing, because I'm reading also a lot of things on the internet, on the newspaper, because people who doesn't know exactly what I'm doing, and those people wrote some things on the newspaper, and I would like to correct some false informations, and I would like also to put in light my foundation, to explain exactly and properly what I'm doing in my foundation and why I'm doing that.
So does Sassou Nguesso have the ambition of one day running for the position of becoming the president of Congo Brazzaville?
Who knows?
No ambition, come on.
At this moment, I have no ambitions really to rule the country, because, and you know, for doing something for your people, you don't need to be elected for doing that.
Denis Christel Sassou Nguesso is a lawmaker from the Congo Republic. He spoke with me from here at the VOA studios in Washington, D.C. This week, the U.S. government defunded its contribution of $69 million per year to the United Nations Population Fund, or UNFPA. The U.S. is one of the largest contributors to UNFPA, so eliminating this funding jeopardizes the world's most vulnerable girls and women, particularly those in crisis and humanitarian situations. Seema Jalan, the executive director of the Universal Access Project at the UN Foundation, told me Washington's decision to eliminate the funding to the UNFPA will have dire consequences for women and families globally.
We were not surprised that the Trump administration would move to defund UNFPA, but as an advocacy community, we were extremely surprised that the administration would do so without absolutely any evidence of wrongdoing by UNFPA. In its own memo from the State Department, the U.S. State Department makes clear that there is no evidence that UNFPA participates in coercive practices. UNFPA has never and does not participate in coercive practices. In addition, UNFPA does not perform or fund abortions anywhere in the world, even where it's legal. The other piece that was surprising to us is that the justification that the U.S. State Department used is basically guilt by association.
What are some of the implications of this action?
There is so much at stake. UNFPA is a frontline humanitarian responder. The U.S. is actually the second largest donor to UNFPA for its frontline humanitarian work. What we're really monitoring right now is that the U.S. is a primary funder of the largest maternity clinic in the Zaatari refugee camp, which is a refugee camp in Jordan for refugees from Syria. It is the only maternity ward for pregnant Syrian women, because clearly pregnancy doesn't stop just because of war and conflict. And because of U.S. taxpayer dollars, UNFPA has been able to deliver more than 7,000 babies. And I really can't think of a better use of U.S. funds to make sure that people in the most desperate of situations, of fleeing war and violence, conflict, or surviving disaster, can have access to a safe delivery. And that's what the U.S. is supporting for Syrian refugee women. The other major area that UNFPA is working on is in Iraq. They have the only clinic that supports women who are survivors of absolutely horrific violence from ISIS. all of that is at risk now.
What about countries in Africa?
So UNFPA works in 150 countries around the world, including many of the countries in Africa. UNFPA is the largest provider of reproductive health services and family planning. Other areas that we're really worried about is contraceptive supplies. UNFPA, through U.S. government support, helps to discount the cost of things like condoms and injectables and IUDs, all of, you know, types of contraceptives that women want. There's more than 225 million women around the world who want access to these types of contraceptives and are not using it. UNFPA helps bridge that gap. So all of that's at stake as well.
So what action do you think the UNFPA could possibly take to try to cushion the effect of this action of defunding?
This is a moment for the world to step up for girls and women, and they can do that by supporting UNFPA. This is a moment for private donors, donor governments, wealthy countries to step up and support UNFPA. But that doesn't take away the importance of American leadership. For every dollar that the U.S. invests in UNFPA, there are 13 other donor dollars that come in. So U.S. funding for UNFPA is catalytic. And it's the best of American values. You know, I talked about the maternity ward in Jordan. When that baby is delivered, the baby is put in a bassinet that has an American flag and the UNFPA flag. I mean, that is such a powerful symbol of U.S. government support for people around the world standing in solidarity with them.
Would you urge the U.S. government to reconsider its action, and do you think that could be made in order to go back to its annual funding of $69 million to the UNFPA?
We absolutely ask the U.S. administration to review this decision and to restore funding to UNFPA because it's baseless and there's no evidence at all that UNFPA is in violation of Kemp-Kasten. There's also an important moment here for Congress to step up. Congress can denounce the decision by the administration and work to legislatively override this in future fiscal years.
Seema Jalan is the executive director of the Universal Access Project at the UN Foundation. She spoke with me from here in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Meanwhile, World Health Day is recognized every April 7, and the theme this year is depression. In Sierra Leone, mental health trouble poses an ongoing challenge. With the recent Ebola crisis, officials have seen a rise in mental health needs. For VOA, Nina DeVries has more from the Sierra Leone capital, Freetown.
Mustafa Kallon survived Ebola, but lost many family members during the epidemic.
Whenever I think of my parents, I feel depressed.
Kallon says he turned to alcohol to cope with his grief. He was still receiving care in the Ebola treatment unit when his parents died from the virus. He didn't get to say goodbye and doesn't even know where they're buried. Sometimes he goes with fellow Ebola survivors when they visit the graves of their loved ones.
I feel like dying. I always cry whenever I'm there. I always feel pity. I always cry because I can't find their graves.
The corpses of people infected with Ebola can be very contagious. During the epidemic, burying the dead quickly and safely was so important to stopping transmission that proper records were not kept. Some graves were left unmarked. From 2014 to 2016, the regional Ebola epidemic killed just over 11,000 people. Nearly all of them were in West Africa, with about 4,000 in Sierra Leone. Those who survived the virus have faced stigma. Kallon was shunned by his community, and it was only through the support from the Sierra Leone Association of Ebola Survivors that he started to heal.
When most time I am among my colleague survivors, we explain to ourselves what we go through. That sometimes helps us to forget about the past and face the future.
Many of the Ebola survivors in Sierra Leone are going through similar struggles, says Stephen Savalli, one of the country's only psychiatrists.
Our data has not been analyzed yet, but I can tell you from what I have participated in that mental health symptoms are quite high among Ebola survivors.
Scientists are studying a whole host of symptoms known as post-Ebola syndrome. Those symptoms include loss of eyesight, joint pain, and fatigue, as well as mental health issues like anxiety and depression. Mental health, however, is a much wider problem in Sierra Leone. An estimated 240,000 people in the country suffer from depression. Florence Bangana heads the mental health team with the World Health Organization in Sierra Leone. She says as a result of the Ebola epidemic, the Ministry of Health, with the support of the WHO, has trained 60 community health officers.
So we are trying to get services down to as many people as possible. And below that, we are training healthcare workers in psychological first aid so they can recognize and do some listening and helping.
She adds it's not just Ebola survivors who have been suffering since the epidemic. Healthcare workers, burial workers, and others involved in response efforts have also reported mental health concerns, like Nadia Nanayila. She volunteered in communities to help raise awareness about Ebola. Hearing people's painful stories took a toll at times.
I cried endlessly. I think, well, for me, that's my way of dealing with depression. Like, I just isolate and seclude and then just cry it out. So sometimes if you cry it out, it really helps. If you can't really cry it out, you have to find someone to talk to.
And that is a message on this World Health Day, for people to talk to someone if they're feeling depressed. Mustafa Kalon says if it weren't for reaching out to others, he may not have been able to get through his depression. And although it's still hard at times, having that support around him helps. Nina DeVries for VOA News, Freetown.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
Amanya bambita lubwama Mva muruja lwa chigozi Dumuzu kuru wa lubwama Musigali andagaya
Uh-huh. And you know that you're on fire. I'll give you what your heart desire. You know that I can take you higher. The only one I want till I retire.
Jogereza, jogereza. Jogereza kawara kombuku. Jogereza kawara kegomye. Chatula vechi babu yevinaka. Jogereza, jogereza. Jogereza kawara kombuku. Jogereza kawara kegomye. Chatula vechi babu yevinaka. Namaganda tetombo nyamonya. Owe kumbenze tunumia baby. Nandi agadenku nani kempeta. Kasite vintu tobi wangu ya. Ndi mwana wampisa nze banjulira. Banjulira ndi mkwa tampora. Jagala kutwaleko mawanga gebweru. Unkuje kukaro. Ulamuze sana.
Days and nights I'll be there for the coldest ones. A day in the life you remain the chosen one. Through my pain and strife you were supposed to come. But you are posted up. You are close to none.
Jogereza, jogereza. Jogereza kawara kombuku. Jogereza kawara kegomye. Chatula vechi babu yevinaka. Jogereza, jogereza. Jogereza kawara kombuku. Jogereza kawara kegomye. Chatula vechi babu yevinaka.
Dance floor, report. Even if you're at work, man, stand up. Don't worry about your boss. I almost forgot to introduce myself. Now, yeah.
Jogereza, jogereza. Jogereza kawara kombuku. Jogereza kawara kegomye. Katula vechi babu yevinaka. Jogereza, jogereza. Jogereza kawara kombuku. Jogereza kawara kegomye. Katula vechi.
chibabu yebiraka jogereza 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 kawala komuku jogereza kawala kegomye katula bechibabu yebiraka jogereza 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 kawala komuku jogereza kawala kegomye katula bechibabu yebiraka jogereza 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 kawala komuku jogereza kawala kegomye katula bechibabu yebiraka.
Murder case again. What is it to see Galamo? Nayakana, to be with me. Woman, you know that I got the quality you need. Lachiba Palam Palam. If you want to take in the boat, I think I'm moving to Nayasi. Jealousy, I am pretty much you won't say. I know. I'm Sangani Bajala. No, me put a baby in a Sanga Matia. No, book any more as a better. Nayaki, not any more you food and a Adela. We got in a divide to the limit. We got in a divide to the limit. We got in a divide to the apology. 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 Faster we are moving like us any more. Faster we are moving like us any more. Got a lot for you.
kumenea mi pressure kizungu zungu.
ye fenomen.
Chibamba sugar passion, kumayo.
Delphine Lumila.
Chibamba.
Pashu bundula isho. Beloti ilanga mamo sisimbi Christiana kwa salosi ya sasa Marie Rims kwa firme Majaki watunda ana maiti dibeti kapamba Pax Medina Mamolina Nzongo Bebe Senzo
Erite minimu Yomamo ketona nema bobo Suna mingi na chakumundu
Kona eko Yellow Masumi, Nana Lotula, Daddy Kusie, Forgotten Boy, Zina Kusu, Rasbila, Shilo Pata,
Avana, Papi Mumbo, Fire Basket, Hervé, Yellow Alec,
El Mara, El Rey Mago, El Pichichi, The King Double. Félix Tyson encore et toujours for life.
Yeah,
baka music and CD. Sebele, za, zambeko. Ya beso besi, ya tonda ki. Wapiti wabwa, isi alali.
Ipupo nerika. Muhammed Kanyesi.
Kuvanda, kuvanda, ya mona simbisya. Nge wa savana.
Meru kito.
Nge wa kuyubudi.
Chose de gao.
Woya bichu wengwe. Mbisya baka lola, sema CD. Sebele, za, zambeko.
Ayibina,
za, za, zambeko. Luma be, le, ushima kwa mamoro kojo. Kukuchu luma be, le, kawa wako wakala. Mada kusaka kumbele mbele kuba ya 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 mazimbo. Ya 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 ya.
Il service express, ma plan, il faut éco ma caca.
That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, producer Douglas Impunga, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaites, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. I remember, as the elders say, the person that neglects to drink from the spring of experience is likely to die of thirst in the desert of ignorance. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Some 14.4 million people in Somalia, Ethiopia, and Kenya need humanitarian assistance, according to the United Nations. In some places, acute food insecurity could soon deteriorate into famine. Famines are rare, and we don't use the term lightly. In most cases, people face extreme food insecurity and are in need of emergency food assistance without the situation being categorized as a famine, said Matthew Nims, acting director of USAID's Office of Food for Peace, in testimony before the U.S. House of Representatives. In February, the U.N. declared famine in South Sudan, while regions of three other countries, Somalia, Nigeria, and Yemen, are teetering on the brink. Next to South Sudan, Somalia is the country of greatest concern. Here the effects of the latest drought are exacerbated by conflict, said Mr. Nims. The below-average rainfall of the 2016 October to December season has resulted in a harvest forecasted to be 50 to 70% below the five-year average. The conditions are similar to 2011, when nearly 260,000 Somalis died in a famine triggered by what was, at the time, the Horn of Africa's worst drought in over 60 years. But the comparisons stop there. In February, the governments of Djibouti, Ethiopia, Kenya, and Somalia all publicly committed to regional cooperation and cross-border collaboration to tackle both this drought and, through longer-term investments, the underlying fragility that tips vulnerable communities into crisis in recurring droughts, said Acting Director Nims. Over the past several months, working through USAID and its partners, the U.S. government has accelerated assistance to Somalia, providing food and malnutrition treatment, ensuring drinking water is safe, and improving sanitation and hygiene. And to ensure lasting impact, assistance in Somalia is sometimes linked to activities such as vocational training, designed to help build the resilience of the Somali people. We remain committed to providing humanitarian assistance around the world as both a moral imperative and as a direct benefit to the well-being of the United States, said Acting Director Nims. We do this work not only because it is the right thing to do, but also because it is in the interest of the American people and promotes global stability.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.